All right, so assignment went out, and it's due Wednesday of next week. So I want to sort of continue this story of how we got here. Before I do, I want to ask, are there questions from yesterday or the day before? I got an email from Tim Pollack. Can you hear Tim? No, okay. Good, all right. Questions from yesterday or the day before?
And all shot
ones. Okay. So I want to go on with this story, but I want to sort of restart the story from a slightly different perspective. In fact, I want to take several other perspectives. So what is... what happens as you move some the so-called batch processing to interactive processing? Okay. One of the things that changes when you make that move is that the goal of your operating system design changes. Okay. So in the batch case, what you're interested in is throughput, right? You want to get your job in, get it done, get it out as fast as possible, okay? And in order to get throughput, what you're going to do is you're going to optimize for compute performance. Anything that slows down the computation, you're going to try not to do. In the interactive case, you're optimizing, believe it or not, for interactive response. Because it's very disconcerting to a user when they type a character and the character takes 5 seconds to appear. And I've been on systems where that was true. Not recently. So the user's perception about the quality of their experience as a user has much more to do with response time than it has to do with compute speed. I mean, there are some counterexamples, right? I have a colleague who is now mostly retired, and he spends some amount of his time at home doing ray tracing stuff because he's interested in ray tracing. And ray tracing is one of these applications where you start something up and you go to coffee, and you go have lunch with your friends, you go take a short vacation, you come back and you discover what was wrong with your ray tracing algorithm. No, you discover a beautiful picture on your machine. And that's a case where, you know, optimizing for compute time is actually the right strategy. But up to a point, if you're optimizing for response time, you're optimizing for low latency response to certain kinds of devices. So what's very strange about this is, in some sense, the user typing on the keyboard is more important than the computation in progress. And there are two reasons for that. One is to keep the user happy. But the other is, think about what's going on in an interactive system, right? The whole theory of the interactive system was users are pretty slow. And so we're actually going to spend most of our time waiting for the user to decide what to do next. However, if the user is trying to get our attention, we're going to have to respond to them. So we're going to begin marshaling resources in the system to run the code that's going to echo that character. And in rare occasions, that character will turn out to be a character term, and then we'll actually run some shell code. But the vast majority of the time, we're going to run echo, we're going to stop. So, what's a little strange about this is, as we're marshaling this code, right, we're going to bring up all the stuff that we're going to run to respond to that character. Well, if we bring this stuff together so that we're ready to run, and then we don't go ahead and run, now, we're in this sort of interesting situation where this code that we need to run, that we brought together to run is occupying resource. And if only we didn't need to run this code, we could free up this resource for some other activity, like the ray tracing program. So, in fact, yeah, this thing is working. So, in fact, there's a story that says what we'd actually like to do when the keystroke comes in, we'd like to marshal those resources, we'd like to process the keystroke as fast as possible. Because the minute we're done processing the keystroke, we can release those resources again and give them back to something useful. Okay? So, the incentive structure here is a little strange, because in order to make the CPU run faster overall, by freeing up these other resources, mostly storage resources. So what's happening here is we're co-managing two resources. One is available storage, and the other is CPU time. And in this case, there's sort of a perverse interaction that in order to free up the storage for the main computation, it might be that the right strategy is to give the character processing very high priority, because we know that if we do the character processing fast, we're going to go back to the waiting state there, and if we go back to the waiting state there, we'll be able to free up this resource, and if we free up the resource, the main computation will do that. It's a little fun. And if you actually look at the internals of the Unix system, you'll see that there are cases where, in response to certain real-world events based on this kind of empirical reasoning, the Unix kernel will artificially raise the importance of an activity in order to get it out of the way. Here's another example. If we know that as a consequence of this event, your program is going to die, we would like it to do that quickly. Operating systems are a place where assisted suicide for processors is for processes is completely okay. In fact, we really want it to get lost in a hurry, because then we can free up all of its resources. So another place in the Unix kernel where you will see that the processor, the operating system escalates the importance of the activity is if you send the kill signal to a process, oh boy, does that process get high priority. We want it to die as fast as possible. None of this lingering stuff. Okay? And this is actually a funny story about this. So, many years ago, good job, more years ago than I really want to think about now, 20 years ago, I was working with a colleague on what was then System 5 Release 4. He had done the transition of /proc from a research thing into a production thing. This is not the /proc that you know on Linux, which is a, frankly, badly done shadow of the real thing. And he was writing test cases. And one of the things that you could do in /proc was you could say, stop this process when it receives a signal. And then you could say, well, cancel the signal as though it never happened and resume the process. The Unix kernel at that time was a little imprecise about this priority escalation thing. So it turned out that no matter what signal you sent the process, it would escalate the process a little bit. And if it was the kill signal, that would have the effect that the process would die. And if it was some innocuous signal that the process was going to recover from, well, you know, signals didn't happen very often. Sure, the process got a little bit more time. It was no big deal. So Roger wrote a program that would trap signals on the way and just cancel them, so the process would never see them at all. And then, this was a time when computing resource was not as cheap as it is now, and so you had machines where you'd actually have one machine that was dedicated to several departments, and you would divide its time among the departments. And the system administrators discovered something interesting, which is if you don't actually charge the departments for their time, they don't pay. And if you allow one department to freeload off the time of another department, they will. And so what will happen is at the beginning of the year, when they go to build their budgets, they'll estimate how much processor they need. They'll underestimate it by like a factor of 4, because they know the other department is always idle, and so they'll steal their time. And so they introduced something called the Fair Share Scheduler, whose objective was to be equally unfair to everybody. And the idea of the Fair Share Scheduler is, if you have idle time that you have paid for, and you're not using it, too bad, you paid for it, and we will not give it to the other guy. The reason is, if we give it to the other guy, he will lie in his budgeting process at the start of the next year. Roger said, and indeed our department and several other departments were sharing a machine, and we were operating under this fair share scheduler. And the consequence of this, so what happens when you put the fair share scheduler in place is your management says, all right, what's the smallest amount of compute time that I can pay for, because I know that most of this time is going to be idle. I don't want to pay for idle cycles. Of course, the problem with that is, we were a development tools group. A lot of the things that we did were compile kinds of things. And compile things are very bimodal. You spend a lot of time thinking, and then you start your compile job. While the compile job is running, you're actually using a lot of processing time. But if you've only purchased a very small share of the machine, that lot of processing time happens in very small increments and it takes forever. Roger, being a clever sort, said, aha, I have slash prop. I will write a test program. And what this test program will do, it will send a signal to my process and cancel it. And it will do this over and over and over again periodically. For the purpose of escalating the process importance a little bit each time. Okay. He called this test program flawed. And he went around the department gleefully telling everybody that if you flogged your programs, they would work harder. So, how's that for a long, pointless story? There is actually a message inside the story, which is these ad hoc policies have a way of coming back to bite. This was obviously not the outcome that the Unix designers had in mind when they said, hey, if you get a signal, we should escalate your priority. They were obviously trying to achieve something completely unrelated to this. And somebody found a way to use it creatively in a way other than the way it was intended. So policies are things to do with great fear and trembling because they come back to bite. All right. So there's a horrible thing that the electronics industry has a love-hate relationship with. It's called Moore's Law. And Moore's Law basically, depending on how you look at it, is either a statement about cost or it's a statement about performance. And it says essentially that the size of transistors is falling every year, and that the consequence of that is that you get more transistors on a part every year. In fact, a lot more. There was a long period of time, it was a period of about 20 years, where the rule was, in any given year, you would get 2 over root 2 more transistors in a given area than you got the year before. This particular number came out of Promemco. And it basically said, hey, we're going to be able to grow the memory. By the way, this is for a fixed amount of cost. For the same number of dollars, you got that many more transistors. And there were times when it was a little more and times when it was a little less. But this was a really good rule of thumb for a long time. It's less so now. Furthermore, turns out that up to a point, it's not just that you get more transistors per unit space. It's that as a consequence, you get more good parts per wafer through the fab. Because until you reach a point where you actually have to change the chemistry of the wafer, it's just that you're shrinking the picture, right? It's, think of it as a photography process. You have a certain quality of paper, the chip wafer, and up to a point, you can just keep shrinking the image, and the image will still retain its quality at a smaller size. And then at some point, the feature size becomes so small, you actually have to change the chemistry. Well, here's the interesting part about this. As long as you stay within a chemistry, what kinds of defects happen on chips? Well, there's defects in the chemical assembly of the silicon wafer. Right? What happens is somebody synthetically grows a very large crystal, and they basically take a bandsaw, and they cut slices out of this crystal, and they polish it. And that crystal growth process is not perfect. It has impurities that get embedded, you know, in lumps in the crystal. If you slice the wafer, and the effect of this is there's a certain spot, you've got a disc now, that's your slice, and there's a certain spot on this disc that's just bad. You don't really know where it is. You can't see it. And you could, maybe you could see it with the right kind of microscope, but you don't bother inspecting. Now what you do is you print a whole bunch of circuits on this wafer, all of them alike, right, in little squares on the wafer. You take a second bandsaw and you cut the circuits out of the wafer. Right? And you go and attach wires to these circuits that go to what were then the pins of your chip. Modern chips don't have pins, they have a ball and grid array, but it's the same idea. And then you discover that some of the chips don't work. And some of the flaws that get into the wafer are just fatal. The circuits, they're just not there. Some of them have performance implications. The reason you had three different speed levels on the early Pentiums, it was because of different degrees of impurity in the wafer process. They actually tested the processors to determine how fast would they run reliably, and then they would grade them, and that was how they would decide what clock rate to stamp on the outside of the chip. Well, what's interesting is as the feature size gets smaller, the defect size doesn't change. And the consequence of that is that if you keep the chip area, keep the size of the actual chip the same, you get the same number of chips out of the wafer. But if you can actually shrink the chip, if you say, well, I'm going to get smaller transistors, but I'm not going to add more function, or I'm only going to add a little bit more function, not I won't make up all the space. Then the chip actually gets smaller, and now I get more good chips per wafer. So it's not just that the speed goes up and the cost also goes down. Okay, and the cost goes down at a rate higher than this because it's not just that you're getting smaller chips, it's that you're getting more chips per wafer. Your yield efficiency in the manufacturing process goes up. And so it went very rapidly from a period in 1970 where the state of the art was small-scale integration. You've got 2, 3, 4 gates on a chip. And if you grew up in that era and you were interested in this kind of stuff, you spent a bunch of time playing with what was called the 7400 logic series. It was a TTL logic series. It was come out with by TI, I think it was. Well, Moore's Law comes along. And pretty soon, it's hard to buy chips with gates on them. And you can still get them for use in an undergraduate laboratory. But nobody buys them. Now, instead of 10 transistors on a chip or 20 transistors on a chip, you get a couple hundred transistors on a chip. And you start to see an entire terminal controller on a chip. Or an interrupt controller on a chip. Or a memory controller on a chip. Memories at this point are still fairly large. They're still multi-chip assemblies. 64-bit memory, when that came out, was a big innovation. Hard to imagine now. Yeah.
Where did those things used to be? Error chips?
Sorry, where what things?
Those things that are getting added now to chips, now that they have more transistors. Where did they used to be?
Well, in LSI logic, in SSI logic, people were still building calculators. It wasn't until fairly late in the MSI stage and in the early LSI stage that you saw people building full computers. And the early computers that they built were very small computers. They were 8-bit devices. And they were huge. And in LSI, you start to see the edge of the place where you could start doing a 4-bit microcontroller in a single chip. Okay? But when the first VAX was done, it was done on technology that, looking back, I would say was right at the boundary. It was the early stage LSI. So the SSI is small scale integration, MSI is medium scale, LSI is large scale, and now we talk about VLSI, very large scale. And we've stopped inventing new labels for these things. VLSI just gets better and better. Okay. But VAX was LSI, and the original VAX, it was MSI, the original VAX. The processor module alone, if I remember correctly, don't hold me to this, was something like 4 full boards. Okay, and these boards were approximately the size of your motherboard on your PC. And it took 4 of them to do the processor chip. And it was not a terribly fast processor chip by modern standards. All right, it was units of megahertz, if it was megahertz at all, I don't remember. By the 780, which was the second generation Macs, if I remember correctly, it was a single board. By the 750, which was intended to come out as a low-end Max, it was a chip, or it was a couple of chips on one board. And the whole machine fit on a single board. That transition happened over a period of less than 5 years. And now, you see not only more and more function packed in a chip, but you see multi-chip modules. You go out to the store, right? You buy what you think is a Pentium chip, but actually that plastic carrier probably has several chips inside it that are mounted in a funny way on a little piece of silicon. So now we use multi-chip modules. And as this integration has been happening, the cost has been going down and down and down and down. So when Xerox PARC started looking at SmallTalk, right, and that's where most of what we now understand as object-oriented programming came from. So Xerox PARC started looking at the personal computer in the 70s. Right? And they actually had to build their own machines, and those machines, if I remember right, cost about $10,000 a piece. It may have been $100,000 a piece. I don't remember how many zeros there were. And it was nuts. I mean, everybody said, you're crazy. At $100,000 a machine, nobody's going to buy a personal computer. Well, I'm sure. How many of you paid $100,000 for your machine recently? There's a great quote that showed up in Popular Mechanics in the late 60s. One day, computers will weigh less than 250,000 pounds. It was inconceivable when you built tube machines, right, that you'd get a computer that would be small enough to fit in your keychain, complete with a radio and a sizable amount of memory. It's unimaginable. So the Xerox guy said yes, but there's this Moore's Law thing, and we're going to bet on it. The Xerox couldn't figure out how to capitalize on that bet, but the bet, as a technical bet, was a good bet. And so what's happened is we've moved from a world where computers serve multiple people to a world where multiple computers serve one person. Right? Your watch is a more powerful computer than most of the ones that were made in the SSI era. In fact, even in the MSI era. And this one is not, you know, not a fancy watch by electronic standards. I mean, yours are probably more fancy. Right? So this is a major shift. It changes the way you think about system construction. And it's a shift that, if you step back and think about it, happened over a staggeringly short period of time. It's not like the evolution of modern civilization. We had 4,000 years to get used to it. We had about 15 or 20 years to get used to this, and we're still working on it. So the big shift from the batch era to the interactive era, in my mind, was actually a political shift. When IBM and Sperry Univac, well, what would become Sperry Univac, but what was then Univac and Sperry, right, were building mainframes, it was a multi-million-dollar machine, and you had the acolyte in the white coat. And a group up at MIT, IBM, had a system they had built called CTS, Compatible Timeshare. Why? Because it had been compatible with an earlier machine. And a group of people at MIT said, this is really stupid. We don't like these guys in the white coats. This may sound familiar to those of you who are interested in free software. We think this whole model is silly. So we're going to get our hands on one of these machines, and we're going to write a different operating system, which we're going to call incompatible timeshare. Which they did. Okay, this is the machine that brought you Space Wars, the video game, which probably you've never seen. But it was the first video game. And incompatible time sharing was interesting, not because it was such an interesting OS, although in hindsight it was, but because for the first time the working assumption was you were trying to build an operating system for a machine where there was going to be no mediation, no expert mediation between the computer and the user. Right? This was a long-haired hippie idea when this was done. How's that for another metaphor that has no current frame of reference? But some of those people left MIT and they formed a company called Digital Equipment Corporation. And from Digital Equipment Corporation, some other people left, and they formed a company called Data General. And these two companies, primarily digital, introduced the minicomputer. Now, the minicomputer, in practical terms, it was an attempt to reinvent the mainframe after taking the zero off of the price tag. And it brought these machines from a price where a sizable company simply could not afford them and had to rent time on them, which led to companies like Timeshare, down to the price where a small company could stretch to afford one, and in a large company, a department could afford one. And this broke the back of the idea of centralized control over a computer. Simple rule. Price of something drops far enough, forget trying to do centralized control. It's not going to happen. You may not like drugs in the street. I don't particularly like drugs in the street. If you can't figure out a way to make the price go up in a really fundamental way, you're not going to change it. Unfortunately, inevitable. Same for computing. And people felt much the same way about computing for a while as they felt about drugs. It was a threat that everybody would have access to information processing for a while. Not a very serious threat because most of the population didn't even see it coming. You had a series of books that came out in the 60s and early 70s with titles like Computer Lit, trying to sort of give this dream idea of everybody having access to information processing and how that would change society. And I'm afraid the people who wrote that particular book were a little optimistic about how society works. But, interesting thoughts. How would this invention change the way society works? And of course, it has changed the way society works, but not, for the most part, in the way those people anticipated. All right, so follow this story a little longer, and you can predict, if you're looking at the curve, and you're willing to just suspend abject disbelief. Because look, you watch these machines shrink, right? And you can't believe the trend is going to continue because it doesn't make sense. Actually, it makes perfect sense technically. But you can't believe your eyes that the boxes are shrinking this fast and they're going to keep doing so. And every couple of years, somebody can come up and say, we're about to hit a physical limit. A couple of years would go by, somebody else would say, yeah, but we're going to dodge the bullet this way. They find a new way to do chip lithography. They find a new chemical process for doing more pure chips. That was a big deal. More pure wafers, right? They switch from photolithography to X-ray lithography so they can do finer lines, right? Which is what we're doing now. Now, we're actually starting to hit quantum limits, and that's going to be a tougher one because that requires a deeper level of basic science than any of the bullets we've had to dodge before. But we'll dodge them. It may take us a little longer. You may see a hiccup in that line. But viewed over the long haul, I'll bet that number gets better. Because if we actually get into quantum computing, the underlying factors that make this limiting go away, which is really kind of interesting. Quantum state sharing does not respect distance. And a lot of our way of getting speed is going to shrink machines. And it won't be an issue anymore. So you can see, if you're watching the digital curve, and you apply these numbers, and you don't commit yourself to an asylum for insanity after you see what the answer is, right, you can clearly see that the PC is coming. Yeah.
You're talking about quantum state sharing doesn't respect distance. Is that,
yeah.
Is that reference to speeding up transportation of information to the computer? Or are you talking about quantum calculations?
I'm saying if I have two quantum states that are linked in the right way, it doesn't matter how far apart they are. The transfer of the co-flipping of state appears to be instantaneous, even without regard to what the distance is between them.
But isn't that useful only once?
I don't know enough about quantum computing to know how to answer that question. It's one of these areas that makes my head hurt, and there's only so much I can do at any given time. The point is, though, that if you can make the story work at all for sort of repeat interactions, there's an interesting question: how much is distance still a factor? Right? And the speed up here is coming from shrinkage. I don't know how much that's still a factor in the quantum machine. I think there are other effects that make it a factor, but not this one. Okay, so you can see the PC coming. Right? And if you didn't go out and shoot yourself for being so stupid as to imagine that there would actually be a personal computer, right? It was actually, not only could you see the PC coming, but you could predict plus or minus 6 months when it would ship. It was that clear what the technology curve looked like and what the competitive pressures were. So by 1984, you've got the first Macintosh already shipped, and this, of course, is late in the personal computer area. By the late 70s, you had the Altair, which was the first personal computer. By 1984, you've got the Macintosh shipping. We're already three generations into the personal computer world. In late 1984, Intel announces the 386. And that actually stalled personal computers for a year because it took them a while to ship it, but nobody wanted to build a machine on anything else because they knew even then that the 386 was going to be a critical machine. All right. So, where in Bash you were doing one program, okay, and in Interactive you were doing one program per user but several users. Personal computers, you're doing several programs per user. It's a complete inversion of the way you think about it. So what's happening now? What's happened recent past and what's going to happen next? The big push recent past has been multimedia. How do I get audio delivery to happen right? How do I get video delivery to happen right? Audio, by the way, is much harder than video. Video involves more data processing, but your ear is much more sensitive to delay errors in audio than your eye is. A 10 millisecond delay in an audio stream, your ear will hear it every time. 10 millisecond delay in a video stream, your eye often will not notice. So if you're trying to do real-time scheduling, turns out, so here's a funny story. They did a study. They were looking at how to improve the movie experience for users, for moviegoers, usually users. And they did the following test. If I tell you what the test was, I will spill the punchline on the story. So if I were to ask you, what's the single most important thing you could do so that when you ask users coming out of the theater, how was the picture? Was it better than the picture you're used to? What's the single most important thing you could do? You may guess this, but if you don't guess this, you're going to be surprised and you may think this is really funny. What do you want to change if you want the user to think the picture is better? You might think the picture. No. If you double the quality of the picture, yeah, seats is another factor, right? But if you double the quality of the picture, the user will come out and say, hey, it looks pretty much like last week's movie. They can't tell the difference. You double the quality of the audio, they come out saying, God, that picture was awesome. Right? It's very strange how perception works. And so a lot of the work that's going on in operating systems recently has been how you deliver time-sensitive experience to users in a coordinated way. And this turns out to be a staggeringly hard problem. So there was work initially on what's called scheduling, real-time scheduling, making sure things happen in the right order. More recently, there's been work on, you know what, turns out just running the CPU at the right time isn't enough. If the CPU doesn't have any data, it doesn't make a lot of progress. So we actually have to get the data there too. And now we're talking about scheduling multiple kinds of resources. And this is well known to be an incredibly hard problem. It's actually a very old problem. And still an open problem. The next two trends in kernel design, in my opinion, and you should take this with a huge grain of salt, anybody who makes predictions in our business and puts money on them, we call them bankrupt people, are going to be security and virtualization.
Which is that in many ways security falls under virtualization. And then what kind of model you're looking at.
That's not necessarily the case. Let me explain what I mean by the two terms. There is definitely between the two. It's not accurate to say that they're the same. So for a lot of years, people have said, hey, security is going to be really important. People will pay for it. Lo and behold, people never pay for it. So anybody comes up and says, security is now an important issue, you should be justifiably skeptical, especially when there's somebody in the security field as I am and they have a vested interest in the state. But let me tell you what I think changed. This is a really incredibly secure computer device. Right? It's like holding up a quarter. You can flip it. It gives you ones and zeros. They're very reliable ones and zeros. It doesn't land on its edge very often. And there aren't a whole lot of things that you can do to either detect the outcome if you're in the next room or influence the outcome. Of course, it's not a very useful computing device because it doesn't do anything. A lot of the reason that this thing is a secure computing device, or my watch is a secure computing device, although not all watches nowadays, it's not connected to anything. Right? It's incredibly easy to make a Windows machine secure. It's a very simple, absolutely 100% effective policy. Remove the plug. The second best security policy is to remove the network cable. Don't put it back. Just remove it. Okay. That won't work much longer because Philips has introduced a technology called HomePlug, which will do Ethernet over your wire to your power system. But until HomePlug actually deploys, removing the network wire will work fine. But the minute you put the network wire up, it's not about physical control. And it's not sufficient to do what we might call configuration management in the wire. Be careful about what you install. Right? Up to a point, if you're a little cautious and a lot paranoid and a little bit knowledgeable, not even a lot knowledgeable, you say, look, I'll only install software from people whose processes I believe are okay. And yes, I will get caught sometimes because those processes do get fooled. Microsoft has shipped golden, well, not shipped, but they have pressed CDs from golden masters that had viruses on the master at least four times. The miracle is that it doesn't happen all the time. And they're pretty good at this. Right? So you said, look, I'm only going to install software from yet reputable parties and I'm not going to connect to a network. The chances of you staying in control of the machine are actually decent. The problem is that machine isn't very interesting. Right? It can't send email to your friends, right? And a lot of what makes computing attractive is our ability to communicate with other people who have computers. The catch is,
in light of what you said at the beginning of the class, isn't that a new phenomenon?
Isn't what a new phenomenon?
Using computers to communicate rather than just process information?
Yes. Yeah. And one of the things that changes as you go into the mini computer world is you start to see networks springing up. And the initial driver for that, IBM had used networks for terminal systems and for ATM machines somewhat earlier. But those networks were closed networks. They weren't viewed as ways for companies to communicate with each other except under very, very constrained conditions. But the internet was a different thing. And CSNet was a different thing. So two things happened. So one was CSNet, which was a way to link computer science, academic computer science departments, and research groups by email, sort of. Three things. The second was Usenet and UUCP, which was initially written by Peter Honeyman. Peter's comment some years later was, good God, if I'd understood how heavily people were going to use this, I would have spent more than a weekend writing it. Usenet at one point accounted for gigabytes of traffic, most of which traveled over 1,200 baud modems. The monthly Usenet phone bill for one group at Murray Hill that was acting as a hub was over $250,000 a month. And this was in the early 80s. I mean, it's still a lot of money now. It was a lot more money then. Fortunately, being the phone company, they didn't have to pay. But the killer for this was the internet, which was driven by DARPA. And then by BBN, and then it became a public thing. So, in fact, the critical thing was the decision by DARPA to have Berkeley do the initial TCP/IP stack and make it public. And it was both that it existed and that it was widely deployable. And after that, there were companies, including AT&T, who said, you know, the internet doesn't really work. It's not robust. And it's true, it's not robust. But it was inevitable. I mean, these guys were, you know, they were blowing at a thunderstorm to hope that the rain would go away. You know, it's not going to work. So yes, there was a big change there, and that change became part of what we think of as computing. But here's the problem. Not all the people sending you messages like you. Or even if they don't really care about you, they're not all sending messages that are in your interest. So the combination of people coming to trust computing and computing becoming reliable enough that people were actually willing to put information they thought was critical on a computer, whether it was business information or personal information or banking information, combined with connecting those computers to other people who would like to have that information. Right? We now have a war going on. And finally, the degree of connectivity with, and I think primarily it's brought me into the home, it's done it, it's pushed us over the wall. Right? It used to be the case, look, if somebody broke into a computer, it was a computer at IBM or General Electric, some big company, right? And if somebody said to you in your house, computing is kind of dangerous, you would say, well, yeah, if I'm General Electric, it's kind of dangerous, but it's no big deal for me. I don't have anything on my computer I care about. Try doing banking today in the United States without a web browser. Right? The preferred means from the bank perspective for you to talk to them is the web browser. Why? Because then they don't have to pay tellers. Now it matters to you. And as broadband comes to the home, those people who used to play games against General Electric or, you know, pick your favorite company, it doesn't matter which the company is, they're now playing games with you because most of you don't know how to defend. You're much easier targets. And people are getting fed up. And we're seeing an increasing sense of groundswell push for liability in software. Now that's going to be a hard push. But what is going to happen is that as companies desperately dodge liability, they'll change the law that would support software liability, they will be forced to pay more attention to software quality. And software quality includes robustness against attack now, and that's what changes. The other thing that's going to come is virtualization, because unfortunately, we are not going to make legacy operating systems secure. And it's not that the software developers are bad, they're quite good. It's that some of the insecurities and vulnerabilities are built into the APIs of this software. You can't call the Unix API, you can't call the open routine without already making a mistake. The mistake is built into the specification of the open routine. The Unix design already has built into it the idea that there is a global namespace called a file system that is shared by everybody and writable at least someplace to everybody. You can't use the Unix permissions model without already making a mistake. One of the fundamental operations in the Unix permissions model, if I own a file, I can give you access. You don't have to agree to take it. I can give it to you. And the absence of agreement there is a big problem. The catch is, if you fix those APIs, which in this case means removing them, every application that runs will break. So we're going to have a very awkward, ugly, expensive, long transition process. And one of the solutions is virtualization. People are saying, okay, I can't give up on this software. I will move it one piece at a time because it's impossibly expensive. And I'm going to live in a world where in one box I'm going to run Windows or Unix or Mac OS or pick your favorite OS. And in the other box, I'm going to run a new OS. And initially, that new OS, it's only going to do a couple things. Over time, more of my function will commit to it, and I'll make the commitment to run a different API there that is more defensive. So yes, I think virtualization and security are tied. Virtualization is actually not deploying because of security. It's deploying because people want to rent servers. But it is deploying. The other reason that it was talked about, although it appears that it's not clear how much the commitment has stayed alive, Microsoft was talking about using things that are similar to virtualization technology to do digital rights management. And I don't think they're going to be able to make that actually work. It's technically much harder than you realize. It is doable. I'm just not sure it's doable by Microsoft. Okay, so these are the sort of things that people are looking at now. Let's see, what else, if anything, do I want to say about this stuff? Okay, starting Monday, I'm going to switch gears, right? So what I'm trying to do in these couple of lectures is to write a little bit of introduction, a little bit of historical context. The problem I'm starting on Monday with is, how do you manage memory? And let me preface this by saying, the hard part of operating systems is you don't ever get to lie to yourself about what you have to work with. You look at the specification for Java or ML or any of the same programming languages. Somewhere, buried down at the bottom of the language specification, there's a statement that goes something like this. Assume that the world consists of an infinite number of memory cells. Now, the last time I went to CompUSA and tried to buy an infinite number of memory cells, I was not successful. Okay. And so systems like Java and lots of other systems use garbage collection as a way to simulate having this infinite number of memory cells. Operating systems can't do that. The ability to do that relies on having some substrate underneath you that supports you. And the hardware doesn't provide the right kind of substrate. Also, Java has the problem of what happens if I run out. Well, I'll ask for more. Operating systems can't do that. You only put so much RAM in the machine. That's all we got. And in an operating system, there are often hard requirements for response time. If you don't respond to certain things fast enough, bad things happen. One of the things you have to respond to quickly, you're losing power. And there are a few others. And things like garbage collection, which are fine ways to simulate a hypothetical memory, they don't work in an operating system because you can't work on those because they introduce timing changes. Okay, so operating systems are places where, one, everything has to work, two, everything has to work reliably, and three, everything has to work within real resource. This is the place where the rubber actually has to meet the road. The problem is that inevitably it meets the road right about where your toe is. The trick is to get your toe out. Okay. And the reason operating systems are hard is there's no support environment, and you have a very large number of simultaneous things, all of which have to be satisfied all at the same time. It's not good enough to solve half the problem. So that's sort of the context for the course, is how do you do all that all at the same time? And so tomorrow I'll start in on how do you think about memory allocation and what are the issues and why. Okay, so I've run a little late, for which I apologize. And next time I will avoid that, at least I'll try harder. Thank you.